Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we will continue with the study of the Sutta Nipata. And now we come to Sutta number 7. This is called the Vasala Sutta. For those of you who have the translation, this is on page 13. Today, I'm not going to read the Pali from every verse because I want to cover this entire sutta in one day. And so I have to move through it fairly quickly. Okay, the title of the sutta, Vasala, the word Vasala means an outcast, or it's translated as outcast. But the word Vasala, it's not just, you call it an objective, impersonal word for outcast, like the English word outcast, but rather it's a very denigrating, derogatory word. Word with overtones of contempt and denigration and rejection. It's like calling a person in modern American lingo, it's like calling, almost like calling somebody a bum or a worthless fellow. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living near Savatthi in the monastery built by Anathapindika. And according to the commentary, which provides the kind of background to the sutta, that day, very early in the morning, the Buddha had, as usual, he did his early morning meditation, entering upon the meditation of great compassion, the Maha Karuna Samapatti. Then when he came out from that meditation, he scanned the world with his supernormal vision to see whether there was anybody who had the potential to reach some stage of realization or who had the potential to become converted or transformed to become a disciple. And when he did this, he saw there came into his field of vision a Brahmin from the Bharadvaja clan. This was a very prominent, very elite clan of Brahmins. And they call this Brahmin Agika Bharadvaja because he was devoted to the fire ritual, which I'll explain. Okay, so then when the time came to go on alms round, the Buddha put on his upper robe, and then taking his bowl, he went into Savatthi for alms. And he expressly went in the direction of the Brahmin Agika Bharadvaja. Okay, now it's said that at the time, in the house of the Brahmin Agika Bharadvaja, a fire was lit and the objects for sacrifice were made ready. And I have to give a little background explanation to this. The Brahmins were followers of the Vedas, and the Vedas recognized a plurality of gods, many gods, all of whom were considered different aspects, different manifestations of the divine reality, the divine force, and different verses or sections of the Vedas would extol different gods as being supreme or preeminent. But one of the gods who is repeatedly extolled in the Vedas is the god Agni. Now, the gods of the Vedas usually represent different forces of nature, different cosmic powers, because all of these forces of nature, cosmic powers, are considered manifestations, expressions of the one divine reality. And this divine reality expresses itself in the forces of nature, and those forces are considered to be supervised, managed, and permeated by different aspects of the divine reality. And when the divine reality expresses itself in different aspects through these different forces of nature, the divine reality is conceived of as different gods. And one of the most pervasive forces in the natural world, and one of the most important forces in human life, is fire. Because human beings depend upon fire for heat to protect them from the cold. They use fire to cook their food. And so we can say that all life is dependent, sustained by fire. And the Vedas see fire as occurring not only in the manifest form, that is, in the form of burning flame-like substances, but fire pervades all physical reality. In other types of physical reality, apart from what we call fire, the fire is dormant or latent. When a physical object catches fire, then fire becomes manifest. And whether fire is dormant or fire is manifest in the form of flames and heat, the supernatural reality, which is responsible for the energy of the universe, that supernormal, supernatural reality, that divine reality, is conceived of as the god, the divinity, called Agni. And so from the very early periods of the Vedic history, Agni, the god of fire, assumed a position of great importance, and the Brahmins would maintain wherever they resided, they would maintain a constant fire, which they would keep always burning, a perennial flame, which they would feed with fuel, even with oil, with butter, so that it is always burning. And then on special occasions, they would use that flame to perform a sacrifice, a great sacrifice. They would feed the flame. In the early days, they would sacrifice animals and feed the flesh of the animals to the flames. By the Buddha's time, there came, to some extent, among certain groups of Brahmins, a rejection of animal sacrifice, but instead there took place the sacrifice of non-animal products. They would offer butter, ghee, honey, piasin, that's a kind of sweet porridge, grains, all of these objects which people would use to sustain their bodies. These were considered delicacies, delicious, special delicious foods. The Brahmins would offer this with great reverence, great veneration to the fire, their flame, considering that flame as their own personal embodiment, their own personal, call it incarnation, of the great universal, all-pervading god of fire, Agni. And so this Brahmin, Akika Bharadvaja, was a devotee of the god Agni. In fact, his name Agika, this is actually Agi is the Pali form of Sanskrit Agni. So in Sanskrit, his name would have been Agnika Bharadvaja. And so just at this time, he was getting ready to perform a sacrifice, a devotional offering to his own chosen divinity, Agni, the god of fire. He had set up all of his cereals, his grains, his honey, his ghee. He had the flame prepared. He was just about to make the sacrifice. And now it was the morning, and the Buddha was going on alms round from house to house. The Pali text uses the expression that the Buddha was going sapadanam pindaya charamano. This is a special way of going an alms round. It means going an alms round without choosing or selecting the houses. But one goes to each house without passing any house by. This is considered a special ascetic vow, because some monks or wanderers, when they would go on alms round, they would select the houses of wealthy people or well-to-do people and skip by the houses of the poor people, because they want to get good offerings, and so they don't want to go to poor houses where they might just get a few spoons of rice and nothing more. And others would choose the houses of followers of their sect, their religion, and go to those houses, but they would skip by the houses of followers of other religions, of other teachers. But the Buddha would go on sapadana pindapata, which means he goes to each house, not discriminating whether it's rich or poor, not discriminating whether the people who live there are his own devotees, the followers of other teachers, whether they're Brahmins or Kshatriyas or merchants. He goes to every house. And so now, as he's going through the street, he comes to the house. He's approaching the house of this Brahmin, Agi Bharadvaja. And he's just about to pass by in front of that house when the Brahmin sees him. And now the Brahmin gets, when he sees this ascetic, this wanderer coming with the shaved head, no beard, with these saffron or ochre robes, the Brahmin gets angry and worried and frightened. Why? Why does he get angry and frightened? Because it was a belief amongst the Brahmins that the ascetics, the wandering ascetics, were a bad group of people who were harming the foundations of society. They had given up the household life. They were giving up the process of procreation. They didn't perform the Brahminic rituals. They didn't submit to the authority of the Brahmins. They had a different set of beliefs, different from the beliefs of the Brahmins. They didn't accept the authority of the Vedas. And so the Brahmins considered them to be heretics, even sometimes nihilists, following a wrong path, a misleading path, teaching a misleading path. And they considered the sight of a samana, the sight of an ascetic, to be inauspicious, unlucky, even a sign of future misfortune. Somewhat like people in America used to believe, I don't know if they believe this anymore, that going out of the house and seeing a black cat first thing in the morning is an unlucky sight. And so here the Brahmin, he's just about to start performing his ritual to his beloved god Agni. Everything is ready. He's probably just about to put the offering objects into the fire. And what happens? This bad, unfortunate, inauspicious figure suddenly starts to cross the threshold of his shrine room. The shrine room is at street level, open to the street. And so he calls out angrily, using very offensive language, to the Buddha. He says, "Stop there, shaveling." Shaveling, because the head is shaved. "Stop there." The word is not really ascetic, but it's a denigrating term, samanika. It's kind of putting down the ascetic. We would say something like, "Stop there, you rascal ascetic. Stop there, you good-for-nothing outcast." Okay, so the Brahmin speaks with very harsh tones, a very angry mind. He speaks to the Buddha in this way. And now the Buddha maintains perfect equanimity, an undisturbed mind, and all the time as the Buddha is going on alms round, as he's coming to each house, he's radiating loving kindness to the people in that house. He's radiating the mind of boundless metta, boundless loving kindness. And so when the Buddha hears the Brahmin addressing him in this way, the Buddha turns to this Brahmin, still radiating that mind of loving kindness to the Brahmin, and says, "Brahmin, do you know what an outcast is? Would you recognize an outcast? Or do you know the things that constitute an outcast?" And since the Buddha is speaking with such a calm mind, with a mind of such soft, gentle, loving kindness, the Brahmin is immediately transformed. His attitude changes. His anger falls away, and he's suffused by the Buddha's loving kindness and compassion. And suddenly his pride, his Brahmin pride, dissolves. And just like a little child, he just admits to the Brahmin, "No, indeed, Master Gotama, I cannot recognize an outcast or those things that constitute an outcast. It would be profitable, or it would be good, Master Gotama, if you would explain to me what is an outcast and what are the things that constitute an outcast." Okay, now before I come to the Buddha's verses themselves, I have to explain a little bit about the Indian social structure. Okay, in the Indian social structure organized at this period, organized society into four main social groups. In the Brahmin view, at the top of the social order were the Brahmins. These were the priests who performed the sacred rituals of the Vedas. But at this time, at the time of the Buddha, many Brahmins had become a kind of wealthy landed aristocracy. Then after the Brahmins came the Kshatriyas. These were the rulers, administrators, and warriors. The third social group were the Vaishyas or Vaisas. These were the landowners and merchants. The fourth group were the Shudras. These were the workers and servants. Then outside these four main social groups, and most people fit into the fourth group. They were the workers, the servants, messengers. But outside these four groups, there was a kind of large group of people who didn't fit into the class system at all. And these were considered the outcasts. Now, membership in the Brahmin view, membership into any of these social groups was determined by birth. So by birth, one becomes a Brahmin. If one is born into a Brahmin family, one is a Brahmin. By birth, if one is born of Kshatriya parents, one becomes a Kshatriya, that is, a member of the warrior or administrative class. If one is born to merchant parents, one becomes a merchant or landowner. If one is born to worker parents, one becomes a member of the working class. And if one is born within a family of outcasts, one is an outcast and remains an outcast. And so this view was promoted a very rigid social structure in which a person's position in society was entirely determined by their birth. Now, in his verses, the Buddha is going to suggest a very different criterion for regarding a person as an outcast, as someone who is worthless, of low character, of a degraded status, a criterion which is very different from that of birth. Okay, now the Buddha begins speaking. Okay, his first verse, he says, whoever is angry, who harbors ill will, who is evil-minded, and I don't agree with envious. I think the correct translation would be who is evil-minded and a denigrator, that is, who smears others, who conducts a smear campaign against others, whose views are defective or destructive, and who is deceitful or hypocritical. He is known as an outcast. And why does the Buddha begin in this verse describing an outcast with these terms? Why does he do so? All of these terms describe the mind of the Brahmin when the Brahmin started to address the Buddha. The Brahmin had an angry mind. He had ill will to the Buddha. He was denigrating or smearing the Buddha. And he had these deluded views, the view that because somebody is a samana, an ascetic, that one is inauspicious, bad luck, a sign of misfortune. Okay, then the Buddha continues, and now he goes into, you can say, a moral criterion for judging somebody to be an outcast. And here, these first verses, you'll see, are modeled or structured according to the violation of the five precepts, at least some of the five precepts. We begin with the first violation of the first precept. Whoever destroys life, whether the life of a bird, an animal, an insect, or a fish, who has no compassion for any living being, he is known to be an outcast. Then another violation of the first precept on a larger scale. Whoever is destructive or aggressive in town and country and is known as a vandal or a thug, he is known to be an outcast. Okay, so we have these two verses concerned with those who don't observe even this basic principle of respecting the lives of others. Then we have three verses concerned with the violation of the second precept. Okay, whoever steals what is considered to belong to others, whether taking things from the village or from the forest, he is known to be an outcast. Okay, that is the most obvious, the most evident form of stealing. But now there are subtle ways in which one could be stealing without recognizing it. Verse number 5 here. Whoever, and this is something you have to be careful of, because you could also be guilty of this without knowing it. Whoever has contracted a debt, and then asked to pay up, defaults and says, I am not indebted to you. That is, if you've taken a debt and then later you try to escape from that debt by denying that you ever took the debt. Maybe you entered into some contract. Well, if you entered into a written contract, then there's some written statement that could be used against you. But it might be that you just borrowed money from a friend and you had a kind of personal agreement that you would pay. But then when you get into trouble and then time comes, your friend needs money, you have to pay up. Instead of just pleading for more time and you're aware that there's no other person around as a witness, so you can just deny that you borrow the money from that person. There's nobody else to testify. You could say, who is your witness? Nobody can stand up and testify that I didn't borrow any money from you. And you think you get away with it, but that is a form of theft. Okay, next one. Whoever is desirous of stealing even a trifle and takes such a thing, having killed a man going along the road, I'm really not sure that the verse means that. I have to say, I don't see that so clearly in the Pali. The thing about killing a man along the road. The first part, whoever is desirous of stealing even a trifle and takes such a thing, we'll leave apart the thing about killing a man along the road. But sometimes you could think there's no harm in taking even little things. For example, if you be working someplace in an office, you see they have many envelopes, many postage stamps, some stationery. You think the company is rich. They're not going to mind if, certainly they're not going to go bankrupt if I take a few, a dozen or so envelopes, a little stack of type of printing paper, a few postage stamps. I could take that and they're not going, nobody's going to miss it. And so it seems just like a trifle. But if one starts taking little things, then first it builds up the habit of stealing within one's mind. So later, you see not just a few envelopes, but a stack of envelopes, you know, wrapped up with in a wrapper. And then you think, no harm if I take a stack of envelopes. Then you see a whole roll of postage stamps, and certainly that's not going to bankrupt the company. So you take a whole roll of stamps, and maybe there's a new print, new ribbon for the printer, and it exactly fits your printer, and so the company is not going to go bankrupt if you were to take that printer and use it for your printer. And then maybe a month later, there is a maybe a new computer mouse that the company has not started to use yet, and it exactly fits your computer, and so you could take that mouse home to your computer, and nobody is going to miss it. And so before long, when one gets into the habit of taking little things, before long, one starts taking bigger things. Okay, the next verse deals with false speech, and it takes as the example the most serious breach of false speech. This is committing perjury, bearing false witness, either for one's own benefit, for the sake of others, could be for one's friends, family, or for the sake of some profit, to gain some material profit. If one speaks falsely in a court, saying that one has seen what one has not seen, heard what one has not heard, and so on, this is a very serious case of false speech. And by speaking falsely in that way, one becomes an outcast. Then verse 8 takes us to sexual misconduct. Whoever has illicit affairs with the wives of his relatives or friends, either by force or through mutual consent, that person is an outcast. Then we come to those who fail in their responsibility towards their parents, those who don't support their parents when they're old and infirm, then those who commit even more serious wrong, who strike or abuse their mother, father, their brother, sister, or their in-laws. Such a person is an outcast. Now we come to certain subtle types of wrongdoing. And this is particularly relevant to monastic persons. Whoever being asked for good advice, somebody comes and asks for some teaching that will lead to their benefit, for some wholesome, wise teaching. In return, if the ascetic or monastic person teaches what is misleading, see, the verse says, teaches what is not beneficial, what is harmful, or speaks in a covered way, in obscure terms, instead of speaking clearly, directly and openly, they speak in somewhat mystical terms, trying to create some kind of aura of mystery around themselves, saying, I foresee that something very wonderful will happen to you if you make generous offerings to a wise and holy ascetic. Then one should be careful of a person like that. Okay, then verse 12 says, again, this seems directed towards monastic persons. Whoever, having committed an offense, wishes to conceal it from others and is a hypocrite. Okay, this is because when one commits an offense, one is advised to confess it or reveal it to others. This is a principle in the Buddhist monastic order that when one breaks any of the fundamental precepts, one is supposed to go to another monk and confess one's violation of that precept. Then by confessing the offense, there are certain, call them penalties, that are imposed for the violation of the precepts. Usually for most precepts, just confessing it is the way to clear up that offense. But some of the heavier types of offense, if one violates them, then there's a heavier means of exoneration. For some, the most heaviest class, one has to give up the monastic status and return to the status of a lay person. For the next heaviest class, the entire Sangha has to meet and discuss the offense. Then one has to go through the clearing of the offense in the presence of an entire Sangha. But the lighter offenses can be cleared simply through confession to another monk. But if one commits an offense, particularly of the more serious grades, and then instead of confessing it, one tries to cover it up and conceal it, and then pretend that one is a good and virtuous ascetic or monk, that is a path leading downwards. Of course, then one will start committing more of these offenses, and again, one has to keep uncovering them up. And in lay life, if one breaks anything that one considers a really important precept, we don't have like the Christian counterpart of confession, we don't have that. But if one breaks something that one considers a serious offense, then it is good to come to the monastic person and discuss that violation with him or her. If one can't meet with another monastic person, then discuss it with what one considers a good Kalyana Mitra, a good spiritual friend amongst one's lay Buddhist friends. This acts as a kind of counterweight to the tendency to repeat these serious violations. Okay, 13. Whoever goes to another's house and takes advantage of their hospitality, but does not reciprocate in turn. Okay, this is a basic principle in Indian spirituality from the most earliest period, that the guest is considered a very honorable person. And so when a guest comes, one treats that person with a great deal of respect and consideration, but the person who is a guest should also make it a point from time to time to invite his friends to his home and treat them as guests. Okay, then I'm going to go through the others a little more quickly now. Whoever deceives a priest, a monk, or a other spiritual preceptor, that person, pretending that they are holy, or that they are virtuous, honorable, but behind that priest or monk's back, they're committing all sorts of evil deeds. This is a common person, common problem that we meet with, or I used to meet with it very often when I was living in Sri Lanka. You see, people come and they invite one to offerings, they present offerings, but one hears about that person that they have a racket going, that they're cutting forests that belong to government lands, selling the wood to others, getting money, bribing government officials, but they show themselves publicly as being very devout, very virtuous. Okay, but 15, again, this seems to be aimed at the Brahmin. Whoever abuses by words and does not serve a priest or monk who comes for a meal, that person is an outcast. Then 16, whoever, whatever ignorant person, makes untrue predictions for paltry gains. This is a fault of ascetics and religious people in the time of the Buddha, and perhaps even today. They are considered sometimes to have divine powers, and so people come to them and they say, I'm considering taking up a new job. Do you think I'll succeed? And then the ascetic will say, well, I can't really tell you until I'm assured that you're really sincere in your faith. Hold out the hand to test the sincerity. Person comes, you know, I'm thinking of getting married. Do you think I should marry this girl? Will a marriage work out? Well, the parents bring the girl and say, we're thinking to marry this girl to such and such a man. Do you think it will work out? Well, I can't really say until my temple is repaired. Okay, 17. Whoever exalts himself and despises others, smug in his self-conceit, this is a way, this is person is an outcast. Okay, this is one of the great faults, is praising oneself, denigrating others. Okay, verse 18 groups together many faults of character. Okay, whoever is a provoker of quarrels, who is avaricious, I think, who has malicious desires, envious, I think, better translation is miserly, who is shameless and who is unafraid of committing evil, that person is an outcast. Then whoever insults the Buddha or his disciples, whether they be renunciants or lay people, so even the Buddha's lay followers, one should not insult, because they also are fields of merit. Then a very 20, extremely grave offense. Whoever, not being an arahant, not being a holy person, a liberated one, pretends to be one, someone who claims to be perfectly purified, perfectly liberated, or even somebody who accepts from others claims that he is an arhant and doesn't correct if somebody's followers say, oh, you are an arhant, we're sure of that, and they just smugly accept it without protesting and saying very gently, not to discourage them too much, and say, no, I'm not. But one doesn't want to speak in that way, but one says, friends, I must say that I have been practicing very earnestly, but such an exalted goal still lies far beyond my present capacity. Okay, but one who pretends to be an arhant, to be a supreme field of merit for the world, he is indeed the greatest rogue in the world, the lowest outcast of all. Okay, now the Buddha, having described those who are outcasts, now he's going to speak about the general principles. And this is extremely important. This is the way the Buddha, in a subtle way, revolutionized, or at least attempted to revolutionize, the social structure of Indian society. He didn't actually revolutionize it because he didn't attempt to provoke any kind of social changes, any kind of social revolution, any forceful or violent social changes. But the Buddha denied and rejected the premises upon which this structure of Indian society was founded. The idea that one is determined to a particular social class by one's birth. Instead, what the Buddha proposed, first, within his own monastic order, he said that no matter what social class one comes from, no matter what one's family background might have been in lay life, when one goes forth as a monk or nun, shaves the head, puts on the ochre robe, the saffron robe, one gives up one's clan name, one's birth name, and one becomes known simply as a Sakyaputta. That means a follower of the Buddha. And so, whether one is Brahmin, Kshatriya, merchant, or worker, all of that caste identity drops away, and one is simply a member of the Buddha Sangha. And in the general society, the Buddha didn't try to sweep it away, since that would have been considered too violent a form of social change. But the Buddha proposed a way of regarding people in terms of their ethical qualities, not in terms of their birth. And this means, it has an important implication, that when you use moral characteristics as the basis for the way one regards a person, it means that one's method of classification is not something fixed and unchangeable, because people are not fixed and unchangeable. So one could have somebody who has all of these faults that are described in the earlier verses, somebody who is, we would regard in terms of those characteristics, as a complete outcast, somebody who has been a murderer, a thief, an adulterer, a liar. But that person can meet the Dhamma and suddenly change and become a saintly person, a holy person. The classic case in the Buddha's time was the murderer Angulimala, a serial killer who killed hundreds of people, and he would cut off their finger and put the finger into a garland and wear the garland around his neck. And everybody, even the king, didn't want to send the army to fight with him because they were all frightened of him. But the Buddha heard about him, and the Buddha saw with his divine eye, or with his Buddha eye, that this person had the potential to become a holy one, a saint. And so the Buddha went into the forest, and Angulimala came with his knife trying to attack the Buddha. And the Buddha just said to him, "Stop what you're doing." And Angulimala threw the knife down on the ground and bowed down at the Buddha's feet and said, "You are my refuge, help me." And the Buddha said, "Come, you are now one of my monks." And Angulimala became an arhant, a saint. And my best friend in Sri Lanka, he's a Swiss Buddhist monk. He used to be a playboy artist in Switzerland with studios in England, in London, in Zurich, and in Colombo and Sri Lanka. He's a great painter. I tell him that in the 25th century, art critics will look back at the 20th century and say that there were two great artists of the 20th century. One was Pablo Picasso, the other, Bhikkhu Sumedha. I'm maybe a little exaggerating, but not much. But he used to be a wild playboy. Then he was in Colombo. He used to go to Colombo and live in Sri Lanka a few months of the year during the Swiss winter, playing around in the artist circle in Colombo. Then suddenly, one day at a party, somebody just shouted something that everything is impermanent. And he heard those words and he reflected, everything's impermanent. What's to be done about it? And somebody told him about Buddhism. And he started to read about Buddhism, and he thought, this is what I'm seeking. Then he went to find a Buddhist teacher. He was ordained as a monk, and he lived several years in solitude, meditating. Now he has a cave outside Kandy. He lives in a cave, but he's also, a few years ago, underwent a near-death experience, so that we had given him up as dead. We planned his funeral. He was in the intensive care unit of the hospital. We already had scheduled what we're going to do when he dies, planned the funeral. He came out of that coma in the intensive care unit, and then he realized that he was treated so well in the intensive care unit that he had a special mission to become the spiritual advisor to the intensive care unit in that hospital. And so now for the last 2001, the last 4 years, he goes, I think, 3 or 4 times a week to the intensive care unit and other wards in the hospital, like the Burns unit, Burns ward, to speak to the patients, to advise the doctors and the nurses how to look after the spiritual needs of the patients. So this is the way a person could change suddenly. Okay, to finish up now. The Buddha now is going to tell a story, his story, about the son of an outcast. This is in verse 22. Whose name was Matunga. He belonged to a caste called the Sopaka caste. this caste that said that they were so low that they used to eat the corpses of dogs. They would take and cook them and eat the dog meat. And that was considered extremely despicable. But this young man, something stirred in his mind, and he went into the forest and devoted himself to meditation. And he developed the jhanas, the formless attainments. On that basis, he reached the supernormal powers, the iddhis and the abhinyas. And he was so eminent as a spiritual master that when he returned to society and came to be known, that even the Brahmins and the high-ranking kings and warriors came to pay homage to him and to serve him. Verse 24, not correct. He didn't destroy the worldly passions. The verse says, Kamaragam virajetva brahmalok upago ahu. That he, you could say, he purged himself of sensual lust. Because he didn't, if he destroyed the worldly passions, he would have become an arhant. But according to this story, this was in a past period before the time of the Buddha, in an earlier era. And he didn't enter the noble path, not the Aryamagga, but he entered the great path. This was the path of the jhanas and the formless attainments. Probably the path of the jhanas and the Brahmaviharas. And so he was reborn in the Brahma world. And so this is the Buddha's example of how birth is not an obstacle to spiritual development and purity. And so then the Buddha says, those Brahmins who are familiar with the Vedas and who are reborn and who are born in a family which recites the Vedas, if they are addicted to evil deeds, they are not only disgraced in this life itself, but in the next they are born in a state of suffering. Caste does not prevent them from disgrace or birth in a painful state. Okay, then the Buddha in verse 27, he repeats verse 21. When the Buddha finished speaking, then Agika Bharadvaja expressed his admiration for the Buddha's teaching. He went for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and he declared himself to be a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. Okay, I thank you all for listening, and may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, if there are any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yeah.
In this case, if a question is asked in general from the people, he who has not cast the first stone he who has not sinned shall not cast the first stone. This was what Jesus perhaps asked at one time. Likewise, is there anybody in this world who may have not violated any of the reasons that one of at least these reasons which were spoken by Buddha?
It's extremely unlikely that there's anybody who has not violated any of these.
So everybody is an outcast at one time.
That is so, yeah. But I think to be really considered an outcast, one would have to be guilty of some of these to a rather strong degree. I think it's very true that everybody from time to time has exalted himself and disparaged others. That's very common. Not unusual for people to steal even a trifle. That's quite commonplace.
We all go to companies, we make phone calls, we don't pay to the company, 25 cents.
Mm.
That's stealing too.
That is so.
It's stolen because we're talking at company time, plus the equipment, plus the phone.
That is true too.
And secondly, sir, how these discussions were documented, because at that time there was nobody with Buddha.
Exactly how this sutta came to be is a good question. The collection of texts, of course, would come from the very early period, sometime after the First Council. I'd be rather hesitant to accept the traditional view that the entire canon was actually fixed at the First Council. But I think it quite likely, quite possible that the Buddha could have given, that there would have been some record in prose. I think it unlikely that the Buddha would have actually spoken the sutta in verses to the Brahmin, that there might have been some record in prose, perhaps even a simpler form of the discussion of how the Buddha had this discussion with a Brahmin on the topic of what constitutes an outcast. And then at a council of the monks or a group of monks, when they were setting the texts in order to preserve this discussion in a form that would make it easier for memorization, they would have put it into verse. So when it's put into verse, then there's a meter, and the meter helps to imprint the words on the mind. Then I think when it's put into verse, then also quite possible that they would have taken maybe records of several discussions between the Buddha and Brahmins about what constitutes an outcast, and then combine them all into one sutta dealing with the topic of what is an outcast.
If I may jump to that Himavata Sutta for a moment.
Yeah.
Now in this case, Buddha is not even present. These two yakshas.
I'm going to deal with this question next week, so I don't want to anticipate, or in 2 weeks, so I don't want to anticipate how I'm going to deal with that issue. But if you're going to ask how that conversation came to be recorded, I don't want to anticipate what I'm going to say. Yeah, please go.
Why is claiming attainment of a spiritual state when one hasn't achieved it held as such a serious offense?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, there's no offense if one is mistaken about one's attainment. Well, first, according to the Buddha's teaching in the disciplinary rules, one is not supposed to make claims about attainment to a monk, is not supposed to make claims to an unordained person about attainment, because it's considered like a form of boasting. But if one is mistaken, say one overrates oneself, one thinks one has attained something, and one makes a claim, and it's, of course, it's a false claim, then it's not considered to be a very serious offense. But if one doesn't have an attainment, one realizes, one is aware that one doesn't have this attainment, but one is making a false claim to attainment, the reason why one is making that claim is because one wants to win material, it could be material gain for oneself. Because in the Indian society in the time of the Buddha, the ascetics and wanderers depended for their support upon the generosity of lay people. And lay people would make offerings to the ascetics and wanderers in the belief that doing so supports their quest for holiness, for enlightenment, for liberation. And by giving to them, the lay people acquire merit, that is, good, wholesome karma, which will ripen in the future and bring them benefits in return, bring them good fortune and future lives, a happy rebirth, and that will also promote their progress along the way to liberation. Also, making false claims about attainment will be motivated by the desire for admiration, respect, veneration from people. And so these are reasons all rooted in the ego. And so if one makes a false claim to have reached a stage of, even a stage of the meditative attainments, like the jhanas or the formless attainments, that is considered quite a serious breach. But to claim to have reached any of the noble attainments, we call these the paths and fruits, these are the stages of enlightenment, that is considered extremely grave offense. And then the stage of arahant, that is the stage of one who has destroyed all the defilements, all of the bonds and fetters, one with a completely and utterly purified mind, so that there's no trace of any defilements left. And so for somebody to falsely claim that status, it's like, let us say, one goes to a company, one thinks one is starting to work in a company, I'm just trying to think of a gross analogy. And one comes into the office and one says, I want to meet the boss. And somebody is there in a tie and suit, looks very impressive, and says, I'm the boss, come into my office. We'll talk things over. Then you go into the office, you talk to him, he starts giving you directions, you should do this, you should do that. You speak about all of your concerns while working in this place. I want to be sure of this, be sure of that. How do I go about this? How do I go about that? He starts telling you this, telling you that, giving you directions. Then the two of you come out, and then you see one of your workers, the workers around, and you introduce yourself. You say you're new on the job. The coworker says, well, did you meet the boss yet? And I said, oh, yeah, I met him. And you point to that fellow. And then your coworker says, he's the boss? You took him to be the boss? That joker? Ah, he's just a practical joker. He's always playing jokes on newcomers to the office. Then you feel really upset and angry with that person, wouldn't you? How could he be deceiving me? I've presented all my papers to him. I've expressed all my concerns. And he's given me instructions and directions. And I've been especially polite and respectful to him. And he's just the office joker, that's all. And somebody else is the boss. You feel really hurt and angry. Okay, that's just the really mundane level. But here you have somebody who is claiming to be a saint, a holy person, who's reached the complete understanding, perfect purity, perfect freedom. And in fact, it turns out he's just a rogue, just pretending and making false claims. And so that that person is doing something very, very, you could see that that person is doing something extremely wrong. Any further questions? David. First, people who attain would not go making public claims to have reached. Excuse me? Definitely they would have modesty. I would say it's no doubt is the case that attainments, the frequency of attainments has dropped a lot because in the time of the Buddha was around to give teachings that were directed to people exactly to meet their needs. The Buddha himself had a very powerful spiritual presence. The Dhamma was in, you could say, the full strength, the power. The Dhamma was very powerful. It had like the uplifting presence and power of the Buddha and a full Aryan Sangha. And so it was like a very powerful electromagnetic current radiating out. Now that electromagnetic current. In those days, it was like the planet Earth in relation to the Sun, or the planet Venus in relation to the Sun. Now we are somewhat like the planet Pluto in relation to the Sun, way out. Though Pluto or Neptune still get the heat of the Sun, though it's greatly diminished. So we still get the vibrational force, the spiritual force of the Buddha's teaching, but it's greatly weakened, but the path is still there. I do believe it's quite possible that there are people who reach attainment. In fact, in Thailand, in the 20th, even the 20th century, there was a famous meditation master, Achan Man, who passed away, I think, around 1950. He is reputed to have reached arhatship. In fact, there's a biography of him which records his attainment of arhatship. It's for free distribution. I think it's available on the internet. And it's quite remarkable, the description of his attainment of arhatship, since his attainment affects not just himself, but the description, the power of his attainment, it sort of reaches out to the Deva world, and then the Devas come to him and they bow down and pay homage to him and venerate him for his attainment. And then Achan Mun had many disciples from northeast Thailand, Laos, and some are still alive, quite old, in their late 80s and 90s. Quite possible a few of them have reached arhatship. There's one famous meditation master, Achan Mahabor, who is still alive. He's reputed to have reached arhatship. And then in Burma, perhaps some masters have reached arhatship. Okay, I think we have to stop, and I will share the merits with the devas, the yakshas or buddhas, the nagas or long, and with all beings in the world, wishing them all to be well and happy. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.